This is CliffCentral.com.
Does South Africa's immigration system render us globally competitive? Or is South Africa's immigration system hurting the economy? That's really the question. And there are a lot of people who are dealing with the realities of this every single day. One such person is someone who I have got to know over the last few years. He's the co-founder of Enervate. He's an immigrant to South Africa from the US, but he has an interesting story of his own, and we've actually interviewed him once or twice before. He's certainly doing his bit to shore up our economy. And Dan Brotman, it's a pleasure to have you here to talk about this very specific problem which you are faced with on a daily basis. You're not treated as an equal in society. It's difficult for you to get some of the things done that you want to do, but you're taxed like everybody else, and the government will make use of you when they feel the need to. You get zero in return. It's been very frustrating for you, and you've become something of an activist in this space. So it's a pleasure to have you here to talk about it. Dan Brotman, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us your story.
So my story began in 2010, shortly after the World Cup. I came to South Africa for a few months during university. I met my then South African partner. I decided to settle in the country in Cape Town, and I've been here ever since. So I've been here a bit over 8 years.
And during those 8 years, you've obviously tried to comply with all the legal requirements around people who come and work in this country. Is that difficult? Is it impossible? Or is it very easy?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky. When I came here, I came on a life partner visa, which was endorsed, and then I was able to work. I actually, within a few years of living in South Africa, became a permanent resident based on what Home Affairs deemed to be exceptional skills. But I really only got involved in this issue around the Guptas. And when I saw how the Guptas were being treated in their citizenship application versus myself, and when I saw that something was amiss, I decided that I needed to speak up publicly and advocate for change.
Well, let's just remind everybody, the Guptas got special citizenship over a period of a couple of hours because they got Malusi Gigaba, the then Minister of Home Affairs, to just expedite their case. And it was done very quickly, and it seems it can be done. Where there's a will, there's a way. What they added in terms of value to the country, I do not know, but we do know how much they've taken away.
Yeah, I mean, the story basically began. I applied for citizenship. I complied in terms of the law. I was a permanent resident and had been ordinarily resident in the country in excess of 5 years. So I applied in 2016, and about a year, a bit more than a year later, I was rejected. Legislation, which I'm sure Stephanie will speak to, says exactly as I said, permanent resident and ordinarily resident for at least 5 years. Home Affairs came up with a regulation that was in contradiction to that, which said that you needed to be a permanent resident for 10 years. And they were rejecting countless people who hadn't been permanent residents for 10 years, including me. So I went to Home Affairs. I saw that they rejected me. I know that legislation always trumps regulation, so that was just a wrong decision. But at the same time, I saw in the news that Malusi Gigaba had waived certain requirements for the Gupta family because they had made a significant economic contribution to the country, which obviously at the time I wasn't disputing. But I said, okay, well, if Minister Gigaba knows how to do Section 59A, which allows him to waive those requirements for the Guptas, then surely he can do that for me. I've started a business in South Africa. I employ South Africans. I've taken hundreds of South African businesses and executives overseas to promote doing business with this country. I think I can actually prove that I've
made. You should get a diplomatic passport.
But I thought that it was I could very clearly demonstrate that I made a very positive contribution to the country. You know, we know that Minister Gigaba was able to waive those requirements within 1 month when they appealed. So I said, I'll do the same thing. I did exactly the same thing. I dealt with the exact same officials who dealt with the Gupta's appeal. They still have their jobs, most of them. And what wound up happening is we were going 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. I was 6 or 7 months in and nothing was happening. It became clear to me that there was no process in place to adjudicate these types of appeals. And I couldn't understand why them and not me.
And let's just remember that even though that's a very unfair situation, it's also extremely unfair when we consider that you have resources, you have a means to articulate your position in some ways so much better than that of other African migrants into South Africa, people who come here as refugees, people who really have no other option, and who have nothing like you do in terms of bargaining power with the Minister of Home Affairs. So even though your situation is awful and dire and has frustrated the backside off of you, it's even worse for people who don't have what you have.
Absolutely. But I decided that I had to use my privilege, not only for my case, but to help many, many people who were also rejected for the same reason. So I said, okay, well, what can I do? So I wrote, it was almost a full-page op-ed in Business Day about what happened to me. And in contrast to what happened to the Guptas, the very day that the article came out, I got an email from Home Affairs apologizing for the, quote, misunderstanding and saying that they were now going to take my application under special consideration.
And did they?
Theoretically, they did, but many more months went by, and it just became clear that they didn't know what to do with such an appeal.
And probably only reacted out of fear of bad publicity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if it was a coincidence that I got that email, but on the same day that it came out, but I started to speak out more in the media. And at the same time, I realized that, you know, we have parliamentarians in the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs who were investigating the what happened with the Guptas, and I actually had something of value to them, which is that I'm one of the few people in the country that's actually been through this 59A process. It's very, very unusual. I think you could count on two hands how many people in the past year or two have gone through this.
Well, that's probably why it hasn't worked so well for all those people who have.
Yeah, so what I did was I contacted members of the opposition parties on the Portfolio Committee, specifically the EFF and the DA.
How did they help? Were they able to help you? Were they keen to help you?
So I found actually the EFF was extremely effective, and I have a good relationship with the parliamentarian on the Portfolio Committee from the EFF. And they intervened both with my case, but also with other cases and people that were in even more unfortunate situations than me. I mean, there were people that were left stateless. There was one man, Raj Gusain. I mean, this is a terrible story. I got to know him actually via Twitter. A lot of people now come to me, immigrants throughout the country, saying they don't know what to do, they need help. And I've sort of become this like de facto connector. So this man, Raj, was from India. He complied. His application for citizenship was approved. But Minister Gigaba a few years ago introduced a mandatory practice of citizenship ceremonies. So you have to go do an induction, learn about the history of South Africa, and then you go in front of a judge with many other people and basically give an oath of allegiance. The problem is, even though Minister Gigaba loved that model from places like the UK and the US, he didn't replicate it perfectly because in those countries, they do the ceremonies frequently. Hmm. So what happened with Raj is he was approved. He had to renounce his Indian citizenship because India does not allow dual citizenship. But then Minister Gigaba simply didn't schedule another ceremony, and over a year went by and Raj was stateless. He had given up his Indian citizenship. He couldn't go to a ceremony because there was no ceremony, so he wasn't South African. His mother was dying in New Delhi, and he couldn't leave the country to say goodbye to her, and she unfortunately passed away. I work with... there are other people who I've worked with, some of whom are even Stephanie's clients. There was a very well-known case, the Mulawai family from the Congo. A very, very similar situation. They applied for citizenship. They complied. They had to renounce their Congolese citizenship because Congo doesn't allow dual. But then they were wrongfully denied citizenship based on this 10-year issue. They were stateless. In the interim, they had a child, a baby born in Johannesburg. The baby was now not born to Congolese parents. The baby was also not born to South African parents. So the baby was also stateless, but was unable to obtain very basic documentation, a birth certificate. The baby wasn't able to access a public hospital.
You can't do anything without those things.
Anything. So I'm extremely privileged in that I wasn't rendered stateless, but so many people were in worse situations.
But Dan, let's just be clear. During all of this mess over the last couple of years, you have paid taxes and you've taken nothing from the state. You don't use the state's free education. You don't use the state's healthcare systems. You don't do any of that.
Absolutely not. I mean, if anything, the opposite. I contribute personal and corporate taxes. I employ South Africans and I help uplift and grow hundreds and hundreds of SMMEs. And government says that it's a priority now to grow small businesses. So I think that I'm doing exactly what government wants.
Government says a lot of things.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, unfortunately, the situation continued to get worse for many, many people. So I took this issue very public, what happened to me versus the Guptas. I began working with politicians. I began working with other people that were in the same situation. And I'm hopeful that something's going to change. I meet on a daily basis entrepreneurs and investors who are unable to stay in this country due to a broken immigration system. I was recently in Berlin. I met a German billionaire real estate developer who builds hotels throughout the Western Cape that employ South Africans. He has been waiting for over 2 years for his permanent residence to go through. We, in a country with over 27% unemployment, you should be rolling out the carpet for anyone that wants to come and create jobs for South Africans.
Right. I want to talk in a moment about the economic impact, and we'll speak to Lone Sharp, who's the Director of Economics at Profit Analytics. We'll also speak to Stephanie Dabandi, who's an immigration attorney at DeSouder Attorneys. And we'll speak now to Dr. Emmanuel Owusu-Sekere, who's from the Human Sciences Research Council in Pretoria. I used to be a member of your library. The Human Sciences Research Council do amazing work. They have recently released a report which says that South Africa may be considered a land of opportunity by fellow Africans, but because of what Dan's talking about, this lack of clear immigration rules for skilled migrants, those skilled people are going to places that are welcoming to them rather than places where they're not sure whether they'll ever obtain either permanent residence, citizenship, or any other kind of designation from the government. So, Emmanuel, it's an interesting report. It's profound in that it points the finger of blame at a number of people, most especially the Department of Home Affairs. How did this report come to be?
It's a part of a series of studies that the Human Sciences Research Council commissioned into the impact of migration on socioeconomic development in South Africa. So we've had other studies like social cohesion, studies on social cohesion, others on the drivers of xenophobia, and this one looks at critical skills. South Africa needs critical skills like any other country, but what we found out was that South Africa has a reactive policy stance instead of a proactive policy stance. So you have countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, USA, European countries who are very proactive. They go out there to get who they want. They have aging populations. They have low fertility rates. They need the same set of skills that we need, and they don't have them. So Africa happens to be the grocery shop of these richer countries, and they are very proactive about it. They have online systems. They have recruitment programs. They're coming for the guys that they want. South Africa has a huge advantage in terms of geographical proximity, but South Africa has a reactive stance, a bit of a superiority complex.
I like that term, we're a grocery shop for these skills.
Yes.
But of course, if you look at this as a metaphor and you extend the grocery shop metaphor, all the other shops are hiring the best staff.
Yes. And you have this, you get very emotional reactions from some South Africans. We don't need anybody here. We have all the skills that we need. But in actual fact, we don't. South Africa has a very lengthy critical skills list and cannot find the right categories and the right quantities that are stipulated in the critical list.
Plus, of course, we know about that massive vacuum in our education system. Numeracy and literacy are very low in South Africa. We have not turned out the skills that we need. And even among university-qualified people, there is huge unemployment because they can't find their niche in the market.
That's correct. The entire skill scenario involves three key things. First of all, you have the category of skills that you don't have at all, or you have very few of, which are very critical to your economy. And then you have the other category where the other issue of the skills mismatch between what the skills we have produced and what industry actually needs. I'm sure you've heard over and over again, the graduates don't have the skills we need. We can't, they're not employable skills. So our skills project is looking at different categories of these things.
I'm afraid feminist dance studies isn't going to get any jobs going in the economy.
No, not at all.
So let me ask you this, because it's easy for us to read the report and see where our deficiencies are, but are there countries that you think are doing this especially well?
Yes, Canada is. Canada needs 300,000 critical skills each year, and they're actually grabbing them wherever they can find them. I've been approached more than five times. You get the emails, you get straight phone calls to your cell phone. I don't know how they got my number. I don't know where they found my CV, probably through LinkedIn.
Bloody Canadian.
Actually recruiting.
So if someone calls you and goes, hello, eh? You put the phone down unless you want to move. All right, yes?
They're actually hunting for the people they need. The UK just came out with a UK Tier 1 visa. Mm-hmm. Even China has come out with a visa for high talent people. If you have a PhD in a certain particular career, it's come for a 10-year visa. Australia, New Zealand, all of them. The US have their lottery as well. So
how speedy and efficient are those application processes?
Very fast. There's an online system where you fill. When you fill in the point, it's like a point system. It tells you, okay, they told me, they actually filled in for me, told me I have 75 points of 100. Can you approach the nearest Canadian High Commission with your passport and the documents and your declare who's your dependent, who's your family, who's your spouse? So they work very fast, very, very fast. And their processes are very simple.
How do you think that compares with our processes?
Well, from the experience of the critical six we spoke to, they found the South African process very problematic, very difficult, very grueling, and huge information asymmetries along the service delivery chain of Home Affairs. You hear different things in different places, and the embassies around the world are not well versed in the policy, and you hear it makes it very difficult to process documentation.
Well, it sounds like important work is being done. Are the powers that be paying attention to this work?
We launched the report of this study, and Home Affairs attended. They brought a full delegation from their policy unit. They were very happy about the findings. They contributed significantly, and they gave us ideas what to look at for phase two of the project. This is just phase one. We're going to phase two now. This study was just based on critical skills in Gauteng province, and the findings are so enormous. Now we're going to all the 8 provinces now for phase two, and they gave us fantastic ideas for phase two. The challenge is we are researchers, so we'll tell you what we found. Whether the policymaker adapts what we found and applies it to policy formulation and implementation is a different ballgame altogether. That we have no control from that point onwards.
Well, thank you, Doctor. It's it certainly doesn't seem that you know we're moving in the right direction. And if we are, we're not moving there fast enough.
That's right.
You know, if we're competing with everybody in a global marketplace, that's we need right. to up our rate of improvement here.
Definitely.
Now, to get there, we'll obviously need to see what law needs to be changed and what law needs to be applied. And to get to that is often a lengthy and complicated and very expensive process for some people. But I imagine that you are not short of work and that you are also not short of frustration, Stephanie Dabandi. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. You too,
Gary. As an immigration attorney, are you busy 24/7, 365?
24/7, 365. And, you know, you don't need a lawyer to put a permit or a visa application together, but it's become necessary to hire an attorney or anyone specializing in this field in particular because of the problems we're experiencing with Home Affairs. So I've been involved with Dan's immigration for the last for as long as he's been in South Africa.
Wow.
And the process of getting his permanent residence, which was in terms of the old regime, was much easier. So South Africa's gone from a flexible regime to a restrictive closed border regime overnight.
So is part of the reason that we have to engage lawyers because otherwise they don't take you seriously? Is it because it's become increasingly complicated?
To a certain extent, so it's a number of things. Not only do Home Affairs not take foreigners seriously? But they don't understand the law. They're not trained in law. They very rarely look at the Act. And they don't understand the rule of law. They don't understand their role as public servants. They don't understand the obligations set out in terms of the Constitution. So it's from that point of view mainly, I think, I'm sorry, that people need lawyers.
That's an interesting point because the labor law changes every other week and there are updates and reforms and changes to public policy in terms of labor all the time. So you would imagine you need a lawyer there. Have there been many changes with respect to our immigration policies? Have there been subtle adaptations or, you know, little twists and turns and small differences between the policies over the years?
Well, we had the Aliens Control Act. Again,
what
flexible.
A horrible name for an act.
I know. It was then changed to the Immigration Act in 2003.
That sounds like something Will Smith would have made at the end of you know, one of those monster movies.
And then we had the Immigration Act in 2003, which was amended in 2005. But the real change was in 2014. We had the public and foreigners were given one business day's notice of the change from this flexible regime to this closed border regime. We had people in South Africa, thousands, who became illegal because of the sudden change. So just to give you an example, the law changed on the 26th of May, 2014. That was a Monday. The Thursday before that, we were told of the change.
This has the effect of making millions of people instantly break the law.
Exactly.
Through no fault of their own.
Exactly. So the point is, most illegal foreigners are illegal through no fault of their own. But one of the big changes that happened then was that pre-26 May 2014, the minister, Naledi Pandor, who, by the way, was great. She issued a directive which said that anyone who had a receipt confirming that they had a visa application pending could travel in and out of the country with that receipt. And the reason for that directive was because in 2010, there was a centralization of processing of applications, and there was this collapse in the system. People applying for a 90-day visa were waiting 3 years.
Oh, my God.
So because of this issue, this directive said you could travel with the receipt. 26 May, so most people were in the country with this receipt awaiting the outcome of the application. 26 May comes and suddenly the law says if you leave without a visa, you're banned for 1 to 5 years and you cannot return. Most officials weren't aware of the law. People would go to Home Affairs, follow up on the application, told, sometimes even written with the signature on the receipt, leave. They would leave, be banned, separated from families.
Oh, my God. I mean, we think Donald Trump's nasty.
That's true.
He is, but... Well,
yeah.
He's nasty, but you know, this separation of parents from children that was going on in America that got everybody really heated. Awful as that is, it's been happening under our administration
in
a country that professes itself to be a free and democratic state where people's rights and liberties are looked after. And we are responsible. Our hands are dirty with the same thing.
That's right. I had one case just at that stage, a Filipino. She was married to a South African, had a spousal visa, had a three-year-old child with this man, and he was working overseas on an oil rig, and something happened. He was rushed to ICU, and she was contacted and told she'd need to be with him. And they would be there for a couple of days, 3 days max, and she would come back. Her application was still pending. She then went to Home Affairs. They sent her to VFS, which is the company outsourced by Home Affairs to accept applications and dispatch outcomes. VFS told her to leave with the receipt. She made arrangements with a friend, because she had no family here, for a three-year-old child to stay with this friend. When she got to the airport, they banned her for 5 years. She then said, please, can you just, I won't leave, I'd stay. My child is here. They put her on a plane.
Oh, my God.
She tried to uplift the ban. It took her a year. She was separated. She had to find ways to get the child to travel to her before she came to me to have the ban uplifted.
You would think that just out of human decency, some of these cases would be treated on their merits.
That's the problem. It's become not only an issue of...
It's procedural, it's bureaucratic,
it's become
draconian.
Inhumane.
Yeah.
So it's not only an issue of unlawfulness, it's become inhumane.
So are Home Affairs, in your opinion, making any strides to progress from this very ugly system that we're currently in?
I deal with a number of adjudicators, and I find that most of the senior adjudicators and most of the people, mind you, actually, that we work with illegal foreigners are there to help, and they want to do the right thing. But they're not trained. They don't understand. They think they're doing the right thing. They're following directives, not law, unlawful directives, and they're too afraid to do anything that they're not meant to do in terms of the directive that they receive, even if we go there with the law to show them that they're doing the wrong thing.
That woman that you were talking about now who was separated from her child for a year, it would have been better for her to just stay away.
That's right.
And to hide as an illegal immigrant.
We've had cases where people, mothers, try to commit suicide.
Oh, my God.
With children because of the process of immigration.
It's also an expensive business when you have to go to court.
That's right.
Because now you incur other costs that you might not incur if you're doing a simple application and everything goes smoothly, which very seldom happens by the sound of things. So a lot of people can't even afford that. A lot of people who would probably want to seek out services such as yours, I imagine, are prohibited from doing that just because of the reality of not having any money.
So I do a lot of pro bono work. But of course, when you take an application to court, it's a high court matter and you need to appoint an advocate. And advocates work on matters or per matters. They don't run practices like attorneys. So when they work on one matter, it takes up most of their time. So a lot of advocates aren't able to either reduce their rate or work for free, but we do try and help. But yes, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't getting the attention that is, or their matters aren't getting the attention that is, just because they don't have the finances.
Are there any good stories? Have there been resolutions that you've been very proud of,
yes,
having been a part of?
Yes. So again, these individuals that we deal with, you know, when you do get through to them, they do help. for example, in the last couple, since we had a roundtable meeting with the minister and the deputy DG, and since then we've been engaging with the director of permitting, I've been engaging with the director of permitting at Home Affairs and his team, and they've been responsive and they've been helpful and they've been contacting us on a weekly basis to deal with applications, outstanding applications, some of which have been outstanding for 5 years. But the point is, you know, I have that relationship. People who enter and apply for visas, who go through the front door dealing with the call center, won't have that. And what I found is that a lot of high-level clients, a lot of investors, the minute they get turned away, they don't bother with an appeal. They just abandon the process.
Is there any possibility of some kind of class action
situation? So we do. We do file class actions. The problem with class actions is that, and the minister mentioned this at our roundtable meeting, there are 57 million people in South Africa, 800 Home Affairs offices, 400 officials with certain decision-making powers, and 140 Home Affairs offices that can issue IDs. So they're very short.
We already know that we have problems with even those people, because suddenly South Africans find it harder and harder to travel all over the rest of the world due to forged documents and irregularities.
So the point is, when we launch a class action case, for example, we did one a year ago, 1,000 applications. They don't. When we get an order from the court for Home Affairs to finalize applications within certain periods, they can't meet these deadlines. They don't have the capacity. And if they do, it takes them away from their work, which means there's another backlog.
So what are citizens like me paying for, and would-be citizens like Dan paying for, with Home Affairs if they can't do what they're there to do? Anyway, I mean, the message I'm getting loud and clear here is, find Stephanie.
Yes,
find Stephanie, because otherwise you're going to be out in the cold. Dan, how does it feel when you want so badly to contribute to a country? And there are thousands of South Africans leaving South Africa and taking their skills elsewhere every day. We have a massive skills shortages, as Dr. Emmanuel's already told us. And we have people, a few, who desperately do want to be part of South Africa and want to make a positive contribution, and already are in some cases. How do you feel when you're thwarted at every turn?
It's hard to not take it as a personal rejection, and it's hard not to feel that the country doesn't want you. You know, I've been told by, you know, I've been very outspoken on this issue, and I've even been told by some senior Home Affairs officials that I come across as a whiny, entitled person, because all I'm asking them to do is follow the rules that they made up. So yeah, it is very dispiriting when they aren't following their own rules. And when you really question whether your skills are wanted here. I mean, when I go to, you know, back to the US or to other countries, people are constantly asking me, why are you living in South Africa? All they see is bad news. And I say that I'm in South Africa because I really feel like it's a place where I can make a positive contribution. But, you know, when I go through these ordeals, this particular last one, which has almost been for 3 years, it makes me wonder, you know, am I contributing to a place that actually doesn't value my contributions? And when I demonstrated those contributions as part of the appeal and Home Affairs didn't even take the time to respond, it made me question that maybe whether it's the US or other parts of the world, there are other places that really would value me, like what Emmanuel was saying about Canada. No one wants to feel undervalued.
Lone Sharp is a director of economics at Profit Analytics, and he's the best man to talk to when it comes to understanding what our economy needs, what we don't have, what we need to bring in, and what we have in abundance. I don't know that we have anything in abundance at the moment. It's a tough marketplace. We see very little growth in the South African economy. Lone, what are your feelings on skilled immigration to South Africa?
Well, I think it's important to understand the scale of the crisis. So at the moment, there are over 850,000 vacancies in the private sector. For a workforce that employs only 10 million people, that's a staggering number. About half of those positions, the vacant positions, are in management, and the remainder in the professions. The question really is, what is the consequence of that skills shortage? Well, you see it in multiple ways. The first is, our workforces are overwhelmingly parochial, provincial, if you like. the managers of our organizations are becoming weaker and weaker. So, for example, the wage in real terms of a junior manager in South Africa has escalated. In 1997, it was 170,000 a year in money of the day terms. Today, in those same prices, in other words, adjusted for inflation, the annual wage of a junior manager is 360,000 rand. So adjusted for inflation, we've had a doubling of the cost.
For more productivity, for more expertise?
No, so my observation is actually that the quality of South African management has been dropping steadily.
In a world where we have to be more globally competitive and cheaper,
yes,
that's
absolutely
not a good sign.
So the wages of these local skilled people are escalating because a hothouse has been created where we're not supplementing the supply of skilled people from the education system. And we can talk about secondary and tertiary education there because the universities have a very tight monopoly on how many people are admitted basically to those professions.
And let's not forget that government influenced the universities because they subsidize.
Right. So we have this hothouse.
Can I be very cynical for a second? Mm. Does it suit government to have this hothouse?
No, it doesn't. I think it suits them in theory, but not in practice. So, for example, the reason, I think we have to face the facts. This immigration policy is deliberate, and it's not going to change except incrementally through sheer force of embarrassment from these anecdotes. Hmm. It's absolutely deliberate. In an economy that's not growing, where jobs are not being created, there is a grave concern that foreigners would take jobs from South Africans. That is economically illiterate, but that is the attitude within government.
It's also in this country a very real xenophobia.
Very much. Now, the xenophobia has economic origins. Mm. So, for example, after Zimbabwe went through its crisis in 2001, 3.5 million Zimbabweans flooded into South Africa over a period of 18 months and seeking work.
And better educated.
Well educated.
Often quite experienced.
Yes, they've been through very traumatic economic circumstances, very open to work, etc. In fact, displaying all of the qualities that immigrants generally bring. So if you can imagine a labor market where you've flooded the low end with 3.5 million Zimbabweans, and you've restricted the high end by a failing education system and the lack of ability to import those skills.
Bottleneck.
It's created a terrific bottleneck with an escalation of wages at the high end and a plummeting wages at the low end. My calculations are that about half of the increase in income inequality in South Africa is a direct result over the last 20 years of immigration policies.
That is a profound realization. The fact that, because we're always trying to attribute these things to, CEOs in ivory towers who apportion huge salaries to themselves, we're also trying to blame political and social goings-on. But what you're saying is that that alone has not been considered the factor that it may well be in terms of what it's done to our economy.
No, so this is a problem where political instincts carry the day. To hell with the economy. So it is a real tragedy. Our workforces are becoming impoverished. It's chalk and cheese to meet a board or have a board meeting with South Africans, South African executives, and to have a board meeting with Dan. Their perspective on South Africa is very different. South African managers are in a state of self-preservation, whereas immigrants see opportunities. I often think that they're talking about different countries. The one where the country is falling apart because it suits them to have that attitude, mm-hmm. and the other group of immigrants in particular who see opportunities everywhere. If you think about how important entrepreneurship is to the economy, and we can talk about that, immigration is exactly the same kind of opportunity.
It's really just wherever merit makes itself seen.
Quite right. And the novelty of perspective that foreigners bring to South Africa is exactly what stimulates entrepreneurship and growth. South Africa has never had a pleasant relationship with immigrants of any race. And it was really the collapse of Zimbabwe and the collapse of Home Affairs that allowed 3.5 million Zimbabweans to flood into South Africa. But going back to the 1910s, South Africa's had a very uncomfortable relationship with skilled immigrants. So, in fact, the Home Affairs Department that was inherited from the old regime has been set up for a century to restrict immigration in service of the local population.
And that is a hotbed for xenophobia, among other ugly, nasty
The xenophobia inputs. is competition for jobs. A lot of South Africa's political and social malaise can be understood as a product of competition for jobs and attempts to reduce that competition.
And we're a net exporter of skills.
So a number that you will find frightening is that over the last decade, the Indian population and the colored population of South Africa has been basically static. The white population of working age, so those are people aged 15 to 64 who are not in education and training, the working age population of whites has dropped by 15% over the last decade. That might not sound dramatic, but with the power of compounding, after four decades, we will actually have no white people in the working age population. White unemployment has actually increased over the last decade. For many years, it hovered at around 3.5%. It's now climbed to 8% over the last 2 years. That's mainly young white people who are unable to find work regardless of qualifications. And their parents
you just have to go anywhere and you meet them everywhere.
And the and their parents are immigrating. Oh. And so South Africa is in a very difficult situation.
But what does this mean even for skilled and exceptionally talented young black people? Because for them, there's probably more opportunity elsewhere as well.
Now, I mean, if you were a manager in South Africa who's charged with hiring people for your organization and retaining them and developing them, etc., if your mindset is about self-preservation because you're getting older, there are fewer jobs available for you, you want to protect your own position. So if you think about attitudes of South African managers to employment equity, it's viewed as affirmative action, if you want to call it, is viewed as a regulatory requirement. It's not viewed as essential if the white working age population is going to disappear in 40 years. This is the scale of the catastrophe in the background.
So that sounds a lot like Home Affairs attitude to immigrants.
Yes. So I think we have to get our head around this attitude in Home Affairs as being deliberate. It's not the kind of chaos you find in the health department or in other government departments where service delivery has its own issues. Here there is a deliberate mechanism not to take this seriously.
And you mentioned that one of the few ways that we will incrementally change that is by embarrassing the department. But it's also possible that market forces will intervene and force a change.
It
would be dire. I mean, it would require, for example, let's imagine that the tax base becomes so strained that government can no longer extract the money that they need from the citizens of this country, and they realize that that's diminishing at a rate they can't control anymore. Then certainly you'll see some action.
Well, already there are frightening indications. 40% of all personal income taxes paid in a year come from 135,000 people. So those highly mobile people...
I think the Vatican has more people in it.
those people are absolutely central to government's continued fiscal relevance and ability. But, you know, the government is infected by ideology. And it is a racial ideology. It is a nationalist ideology. So it doesn't matter if you're black. If you come from another country, you know, you don't have the same merits.
Which is ridiculous because the borders are completely arbitrary and were drawn up by the British Empire. So what are you actually protecting?
Yes, so
there's probably someone across the Limpopo in southern Zimbabwe probably has more to do with someone Debele in the northern Limpopo province than they do with anyone in Gauteng.
Yes, I would say that the way to get the government moving is to tell these stories. I've personally been heartbroken by some of the stories I've heard. A man who cannot visit his dying mother in another country because he renounced his other country citizenship. And then was rejected for South African citizenship. This is a terrific story. I can economize all I like.
It's also human rights abuse of some kind.
Yeah. So I think that those anecdotes are crucial, and telling those stories is crucial.
Well, thank you very much for that quite terrifying indictment of the economic incapacity to understand. By people who really are chiefly meant to be busy with this information, this stuff, and are making very little progress by the sound of things. Dan, how's your story going at the moment? How did it end? Has it ended?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things have happened. Stephanie recently won a court case, which impacts my case. But most importantly, the public protector ruled against the Department of Home Affairs earlier in the year on this 5 versus 10 year issue. Apparently, they're going to be adjudicating my application tomorrow, so my fingers are crossed. But even once my application has been finalized, this is still a fight that I'm going to continue to take forward because I never got involved in this just because of me. I deeply care about the future of this country. And, you know, a privilege that I have in my company, Innovate, is we get to travel all over the world to look at best practice and the future of business. And I go to so many different countries that are doing everything they can to attract the most skilled people, and they don't care where these people come from. I went to Amsterdam. The city of Amsterdam has an actual office within its building to help entrepreneurs that want to set up their businesses in the Netherlands. And they offer them all types of assistance. I mean, could you imagine if the city of Johannesburg offered something like that? You have countries like Singapore that have relatively easy startup visas. So it's easy to come in and start a business in Singapore. And then after 2 years, you need to have met certain criteria. And if you've met the criteria, then your visa gets extended. You don't need to look very much further than Botswana. In Botswana, the private sector meets with government on a monthly basis to discuss the skills that they need. We were speaking earlier about the critical skills list. The private sector was never consulted by government when they came up with that list. It was several government departments that got together and decided these are the skills we think the economy needs. No input from actual employers. So I think there are great examples from Africa and from other countries of what we can do. And, you know, there are great existing models. We don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel. But something really has to change because I have lost so many foreign friends in South Africa since I moved here. Who have, you know, came here and started businesses, and they just gave up. They just said it's not worth it anymore, and I don't want that to happen to more people.
Let's not forget, government tell us all the time they're going to create jobs, but government can't create jobs. All government do is add to our cost of jobs, and all they do is hire more and more people. And it seems in the Department of Home Affairs, not always the best people. Not your best, as Donald Trump always says. They're not the best. This is who they're hiring. Any closing remarks from you, Emmanuel?
Yes, I think South Africa is facing a serious policy paradox. The quest for transformation and the high unemployment on the other side and the need for critical skills on the third side. There has to be a way of coordinating the three challenges to see the role that critical skills could play in terms of knowledge transfer and skills transfer to local content to make them more employable. Rwanda does that very well. For each critical skill, you assign the number of people in your expertise. You must measure they're as good as you by the time your contract ends. Otherwise, your contract is not renewed. So there's a positive contribution critical skills can make. But the policymaker is confused in South Africa. He has to find a middle ground between the issue of transformation, the issue of how to use that to address unemployment and poverty reduction inequality, and the role that critical skills can play to help to achieve those development goals that South Africa has.
Well, I hope your research continues because it's integral to all of this having some effect.
It is.
We need to have people who are doing, you know, the important empirical work
right.
in order for us to know which way to go from here on in. Although it sounds to me like we're all in some agreement about what that needs to be. Stephanie, any comments from you?
We certainly do have a more restrictive immigration regime, but the problem is not the law. The problem is the application. Many, many foreigners would still get their visas if the law was properly applied. I'm an officer of the court. Home Affairs sees me as a threat. Not all of the officials, most of the officials, foreign missions, they see me as a threat. We're on the same side. I'm also there to ensure that foreigners comply, that I scrutinize my clients. I also don't want just any Tom, Dick and Harry through our borders. But the point is they need to engage. There must be an upskill of officials. And the only way this is going to work is if these, well, firstly, employing better quality people, but also training them. Mm-hmm. There's no need for them to not want to engage with a lawyer. I'm trained in immigration. I deal with these Home Affairs officials for almost 14 years. They know me. I'm trained in constitutional law, administrative law, interpretation of statutes, Bill of Rights, whatever the case may be. We should be working together, not against each other. They need to see the bigger picture.
Lone, do you want to...
Spending too much time questioning the motives of foreigners, because I think that's the priority.
Well, anyone who wants to come into your country wants to make a contribution. This idea of people coming in and the cake only being so big and they're going to take a slice that belongs to someone else.
That's right.
It's very old school thinking. Am I right, Lone? I mean, think about this is we can make the cake bigger together.
Economy is not growing, then it is true that the pie is fixed. And more for you means less for me. So there is this competition over existing resources. I think the battle with Home Affairs is going to be harder than it would be in turning around the Health Department or the Labor Department for the reason that there's an element of opposition, political and social opposition to immigration. So a lot of what we see on the ground within Home Affairs is deliberate rather than just chaotic, as most departments are.
Might this be a clue as to why Dan got more help from the opposition parties than from the governing party?
Yes, it's very difficult for me to say that this attitude around foreigners taking jobs from locals, that attitude will change when the economy is not creating jobs, in fact destroying hundreds of thousands of jobs. Immigration will be treated at best as a side issue.
Well, not here. We're going to do what we can to bring attention to this. Pass around this podcast. Make sure that everybody you know who's in a similar situation gets the advice that all of these professionals, all of these experts have already given. And we will also attach to the podcast, give you all the contact details of how you can get hold of people who might be able to help you.
This is CliffCentral.com.